We're an organization that's focused on transparency for the sake of accountability, right? The idea being that if companies aren't transparent about what they do, no one can hold them accountable. Facebook and Google have started doing that in a limited way for elections in the US and EU.
Hello, and welcome back to Exploring Digital Spheres. After a small summer break, we're back with an episode on a widely discussed aspect of our digital society. How do we make sure that companies like Facebook and Google respect human rights, their customers' privacy, and the freedom of expression? For example, when we're talking about something like Free Basics in Myanmar. Our next guest knows a lot about that. She is Nathalie Marichal, Senior Research Analyst from Ranking Digital Rights. She will be interviewed by Frédéric Dubois, managing editor of the journal Internet Policy Review, about her research and work on corporate accountability. Here is their conversation.
Bonjour, Nathalie.
Bonjour, Frédéric.
So I'm here with Nathalie Marichal. I'm myself Frédéric Dubois. I'm the managing editor of Internet Policy Review, a publication out of Humboldt Institute here in Berlin. And I'd just like to start with the very basic question of who you are, Nathalie Marichal. Where are you visiting us from? And
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here in Berlin and at Humboldt in particular, and especially since it's Spargel season. That's, of course, has been very exciting for me as a fan of asparagus. So I'm actually French-American. My father's French and my mother's American. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, grew up in Paris, returned to the United States for high school, and have mostly lived in Washington, D.C. That means that in terms of my outlook on life and how I look at politics and the digital society, I think I bring a somewhat unique mix of American and European perspectives to the table. Professionally speaking, I'm a human rights activist, I'm a writer, and I'm a researcher. I finished my PhD last year at the University of Southern California, so Los Angeles is actually another place that I've called home at one point. And now I'm a senior research analyst at Ranking Digital Rights, which is a nonprofit research-based initiative that ranks the world's most powerful internet, mobile, and telecommunication companies on their respect for human rights online, specifically freedom of expression and privacy.
I see. So can you tell us a little bit about your PhD at first, giving us just the, maybe in a nutshell, what it was about and how maybe this helps us relate it to your work, the work you're doing today?
Sure. So my PhD is a political economy of digital rights technology. And when I say digital rights technology, I'm referring specifically to technical tools that help people either stay more private online or get around online censorship, specifically technical censorship, or both. So I looked at four different tools, which were Siphon, Tor, Signal, and Telegram. And I traced the history of these tools, so who the developers are, who the funders are,
For those who don't know these tools, what are they? What's the common denominator
Sure.
for all these tools?
Thank you for the question. So the common denominator is that these are tools that help people either get around online censorship. So Siphon does that specifically. Tor can also be used to get around technical censorship or blocking, or they help people stay more private online. I closed the data collection phase in early 2018. So I was looking mostly at the 2015 to 2018 period was what I was really looking at. But as far as this, you know, this shift away from the focus on government surveillance and towards corporate surveillance, and same thing, you know, government censorship versus corporate threats to freedom of expression. I think that's a conversation that's been much further along in Europe than it has been in the United States. You know, I think in the U.S., for a lot of different reasons, But notably, the Patriot Act that from 2001 and then the Snowden revelations in 2013 really got American civil society super focused on the government surveillance angle and really only caring about the corporate surveillance from the standpoint of when Google and Facebook collect our data, sometimes the government gets a hold of it. And now we're seeing a conversation that I think is long overdue about what does the fact that these tech companies, they collect so much data about everyone, in often without consent, often without people even knowing that it's happening. And then they use that data to not only to make money by showing us ads, but to influence our behavior by enabling advertisers to target us very, very narrowly, but also by developing AI tools that nudge us to take certain actions or move us towards certain points of view. And this is something that is happening outside of any form of democratic control and is happening really, really quickly.
This is, how do you relate that to your thesis in particular? Because I think what you mean right now are companies like Facebook or platforms like Facebook and maybe Twitter to a certain extent, and Google services for sure. But how do you relate that to what you were looking into in terms of your thesis particularly?
Yeah, I mean, it's not directly related. I chose to write a dissertation not on tech companies and human rights, because that's what I do in my job and have for several years. And so I wanted to write a dissertation about something a little bit different. You know, I'm the kind of person who likes to have at least two different projects going on so that if I run into a wall on one, I can go work on the other and work that, you know.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. So, but they're related enough that, you know, having a better understanding of the movement than I did before writing my PhD definitely helps me understand what's going on in the advocacy space on the issues that I work on.
Okay, so this means parallel to your thesis, you also worked for an NGO?
For Ranking Digital Rights, yeah.
Already.
I first joined Ranking Digital Rights as a summer fellow in 2014.
What was the initial spark, or what was it what draw you to Ranking Digital Rights, particularly at the beginning? Do you remember what the motivation was?
Yeah, so the motivation was that I had just finished my first year in my PhD program in Los Angeles. And I knew that I wanted to spend the summer doing something career relevant in Washington, D.C., where I'd been living before and where my longtime partner was still living because of his job. And one of my professors at USC said to me, you're interested in human rights and you're interested in internet policy, internet politics. We have this fellowship program where we'll pay you to go be a fellow at either a government office or a nonprofit in DC and learn about communication policy. You should meet my colleague Rebecca McKinnon. I think you'd really hit it off. And so I was annoyingly persistent in asking Rebecca to give me an informational interview one time when I was in DC for a holiday. And you know, by the end of the conversation, we both agreed that, yeah, this could be a great collaboration. And she said, sure, like, assuming you get this funding, come and work for me this summer, absolutely.
Nice. You're here during the Republica, the big internet conference, European internet conference here in Berlin. And you also had the chance to organize a workshop at the Humboldt Institute. Maybe you could tell us a bit where that fits into the picture. We understand that you were at Ranking Digital Rights in different capacities and are now working on the different reports that you're producing. Also, we'll get to that. But what exactly was the workshop about that you were involved with here in Berlin?
Sure. So let me give a little bit of background about what Ranking Digital Rights does and where I fit into all that. So our main activity is to publish an annual corporate accountability index. And as we're sitting here on May 8th, the 2019 edition comes out May 16th. And I can't really talk about what's in the report, but by the time you all listen to it, it will already be out. So go ahead and check it out on our website, rankingdigitalrights.org. What I can say about the report is that this will be the third year in a row that we have the exact same research methodology, which allows us to do year-to-year comparisons for the same companies, which is super useful for a lot of different purposes. But the problem with keeping the methodology the same from year to year is that we're not evolving to adapt to the new context, to, you know, recent developments in technology and society, new challenges to human rights that are emerging, and so on. And so my role is to lead our methodology development process to figure out how we adapt the index to the new threats to human rights that have emerged in the past 3 or 4 years.
What would that be exactly? Like, what are the new threats that you're thinking of?
Yeah. So when we devised the current methodology in, we finalized the current methodology in 2016, but we'd been working on it for about 3 years before that. The main focus in the news and in the public conversation was on risks to individual human rights that are directly related to a person's use of a given company's products or services. So I'll give you two examples. One example would be that maybe my cell phone operator gave my text message history to in which I'm talking to a colleague about organizing a protest. They gave these text messages to the security services and they came and took me away in the middle of the night because I'm in a country where organizing a protest is illegal, right? So that would be one example. Another example related to expression would be that I posted something in support of LGBT rights, in support of queer rights on Facebook, and for some reason my post got taken down. And I don't know why. I don't know what I can do to get it taken back. Maybe I even got locked out of my account for some reason, and just no ability to find out what is going on there. And that was a very frequent situation, especially at the time we were developing this.
And so you're mentioning these developments, and you're saying that the way you've set up the methodology up until now for ranking these different companies on a human rights scale, that it doesn't really the methodology doesn't really work at this stage to fully grasp that.
So what we're finding is that a lot of the issues that are in the news right now that are related to the role that tech and mobile and internet companies have on our lives and on human rights aren't so much clear-cut individual rights issues. They're more about changing the structure of society. They're more about group rights, rights at the level of entire countries. So Myanmar is probably the most clear example of this. So over the past few years, Myanmar has been trying to transition from being a military dictatorship to a democracy. And in that process has opened up to a lot of foreign media companies, telecommunications operators. It's a country that doesn't have any kind of a recent history of a free press. There's not a lot of press outlets. Because the country was cut off from the global internet for so long, the script that's used to write the Burmese language isn't compliant with Unicode. Basically, it means computers can't read it. So you can't really use AI to do content moderation or anything like that,
right,
the way that you can in English or German, for example. And so what's been going on over the past few years is that, so all these foreign companies went into Myanmar, including cell phone operators, but also social media platforms like Facebook. And Facebook in particular partnered with different cell phone providers to offer a service called Free Basics. And Free Basics is what we call a zero rating program. And that means that certain types of data don't count towards your data limit. And so that means that as long as you stick to the types of websites or apps that are part of your zero rating package, that's free. But going outside of that costs money. And so what tends to happen in those situations, especially with a very poor population, like is the case in Myanmar, is that people will only use the free services and not any of the paid ones. So the deal with Free Basics is that Facebook decides what can be accessed, quote unquote, for free without paying. And so, of course, what is that? It's Facebook, it's Instagram, it's Messenger, it's WhatsApp. And so that leads to a situation where for a lot of people in Myanmar, Facebook is the internet. Nothing else exists. And because, again, Facebook did not think ahead to how they were going to do content moderation, because they didn't have, they couldn't do it with AI tools, because computers can't read the Burmese language, and they still don't have nearly enough. But when they started, they didn't have any content reviewers who were fluent in Burmese, much less actually understood the cultural and social context. What happened is that a lot of bad actors associated, many of them associated with the military in Myanmar, started running ads, like paid ads, and also kind of generating viral content saying that Muslims are dirty, Muslims are violent, Muslims kidnap and abuse Buddhist babies, just all the horrible hate speech that you can imagine a majority group throwing at a minority group, and encouraging violence against the Rohingya in particular, who are a Muslim minority group in Burma, and with the end result being forced migration, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. You know, in human rights terms, this is as bad as it gets. And this is something that has been studied by the United Nations. There's been very serious reports that draw a very clear connection between Facebook's presence in Myanmar and the specific ways that Free Basics was set up, and the genocide in that country.
How do you provide for that in the current methodology, so that when you're looking at a company like Facebook, I gather there's a number of companies in your ranking, but it's a quite limited number, isn't it?
That's right. So the 2019 index has 24 companies.
24. Okay. And the 2018 had
22. So we added two new ones in 2019, including Deutsche Telekom.
Right. Okay. And so how do you account for things that are like almost national in terms of jurisdiction or focus? To, you know, on the global track record of the company.
Like, yeah.
How do you account for that?
So methodologically, that's really, really difficult. So something like the Myanmar case that I just described, our current methodology doesn't really account for, which is why we're doing this revision process. We do ask questions in our governance section about whether a company does human rights impact assessments before going into new markets, launching new products, and so on. And so this is a case where if Facebook had done an adequate human rights impact assessment prior to launching Free Basics in Myanmar, they would have seen this coming. They should have seen this coming.
Okay, so is this also something that you know from discussions that you're having with these companies, like not just Facebook, but also the other companies? Or how do you know that they weren't prepared and so on? Are you in the in of these companies in some way? Are you in dialogue with them? Or is it more a methodology where you basically look at what you see from what they put out in terms of transparency reports and things like that?
That's right. So it's the latter. We are in dialogue with them in terms of explaining to them why we think they should do things differently. But in terms of the scores that companies have in the index, that's all based on publicly available information. So as you were hinting, you know, you can only measure what you can see. You know, we as a relatively small nonprofit project simply don't have the ability to go inside of companies and seeing what they're actually doing. Similarly, you know, I don't know of a research method that would allow me to say that this human rights violation in this country is 32% due to Facebook, 11% due to Google, and like 29% due to their own government, right? There's no regression that's going to tell you that.
I understand. No, I was just wondering if there was also some kind of privileged access that you were able to maybe get over time in dialogue with these companies, for instance, access to data. To really assess, you know, with some quantitative methodology to see how maybe the impact plays out in more detail, you know?
Right. We don't do that. So everything that's in the index is based on public information that anyone can access without having to log into the platform. Now, we do talk regularly to the companies. Part of our research process is that when we've collected the data and done calculated draft scores for the index. We send the preliminary results to each company and give them a few weeks to respond.
How's the response rate?
Higher and higher every year. There's still a small number of companies that don't engage with us, and unsurprisingly, these are the ones at the very bottom of the index. But this year, even the Russian and Chinese companies engaged with us. So it's something where they're gradually learning what it's like to do due diligence and to engage with civil society. So in that way, we're educating them about this part of the process and the global conversation of setting norms.
I'd like to know what the benchmark is, or if there's some kind of, let's call it, gold standard against which you assess the corporate practices. Like, is there like this one gold standard, or is it more like a mix of indicators that you measure the companies by?
Like, yeah, how? I mean, I would say that, you know, if a company managed to get 100% on the index according to our indicators, that would be pretty close to the gold standard. There would probably still be more things that companies could do to not just respect human rights, but proactively promote human rights. But we really look at the index as being like, what are the basic things that companies really should all be doing to respect freedom of expression and privacy? And, you know, there's been measurable improvement since the first index came out in 2015, but we're still in a situation where the highest scores are in the 60s. And that's not a passing grade in any school I've ever attended.
Okay. But what would be your goal? Let's say if we look at this more on a scale of the next 5 years, what would be your objective with this, with the Ranking Digital Rights Project in general? Is it to really have an impact on companies themselves, or to raise awareness a bit larger in society, like have a more social impact in general, in terms of communication, raising awareness on human rights online? Or is it more really making sure that these companies in the index change and evolve their practices?
Yeah, I think the point for us is to get companies to do better and be better. There's a lot of ways to achieving that. And, you know, we think of the index data that we produce every year as really core infrastructure for the digital rights movement. You know, we produce a data set. We analyze it, and we write about our results, and we present it at conferences and speak to the media and everything. But it's really a tool that we want other civil society organizations, but also regulators and journalists and other branches of government, even companies themselves, to use to figure out what companies should be doing differently, what sorts of best practices governments should consider writing into law, and to build advocacy campaigns around. So we're a very small team, so we don't really have the capacity to do big advocacy campaigns. But every year, for example, we work with Access Now and the Business and Human Rights Resource Center to do a letter writing campaign. So every year after the index comes out, our partners draft formal open letters to the boards of directors of all of these companies, saying, you know, here, you know, we want to draw your attention to the report card on your company that Ranking Digital Rights put out. These are three specific recommendations for where we think you should improve next year. We invite your public response, which we will publish on our website, et cetera, et cetera.
Nathalie Maréchal, thank you so much for the conversation we just had. So you're listening to the podcast Exploring Digital Spheres. And again, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. It's always happy to be here in Berlin. Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen.
That were Nathalie Maréchal and Frédéric Dubois. More on their research you can find in the notes of the show. In the next episode, I have a conversation with Hague researcher Christian Katzenbach about internet policy and governance. For now, this was Exploring Digital Spheres. Catch you on the flip side.